Let's see. See, we have this thing. Let's say good morning and welcome once again to Four Energy Minutes. Kevin Ramirez. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning.
Okay, I think we hear you much, much better now. As I say, you know, you're dealing with technology, you have all different kind of challenges every Monday morning. But it's nice to have you with us here this morning for part two of our discussion on 2025 and what are some of the things we need to look into, pay attention to. This morning, we had Karen Nunes Teixeira. And Karen Nunes Teixeira said to us that, well, we all know the fallout between her and her party, and she is suggesting that there are some things taking place within the PNM that does not augur well for the governance of this country. And she is saying that the status quo, if maintained, may bring us some real serious challenges. Now, I know you may not be able to speak to the internal politics of the PNM, but you can speak to some of their policies.
Well, certainly, I would like to comment on this election strategy.
Okay.
Of 14th of August, 2023, right? I mean, I'm not giving the PNM any free advice here, but I found their election strategy to be very bizarre, because any national election and a local government election is a national election involving the entire electorate of our country. Any election is expected to deal with the burning issues of the day. And what are the burning issues of the day in Trinidad and Tobago? Crime and the state of the economy. The PNM, however, sought to deal with the local content reform issue, and they made that the central message of their platform. And I was seeing PNM commentators and Facebook personalities and so on saying that the UNC should be talking about local content reform, trying to tell the UNC what to talk about. You know, in Trinidad, people like to tell you how to live your life. But the election deals with the burning issues of the day. And I think their platform did not deal with the burning issues of the day, which is probably why they received, I think, 44% of all the votes cast. And they almost lost San Fernando. So I think that to me was strange. I don't know why they would have done that. Probably because they really could not speak to the issue of crime without incurring some serious political liability. And they couldn't speak to the issue of the economy without, again, incurring political liability. So I think they would be in a mode right now where they really have to rethink their whole approach to governance, their whole approach to how they deal with the population. There are certain ministers who, when people put on the TV and see them, people take off the TV. I don't want to call names, but I think people would know who I'm talking about. They would have to decide, you know, in cricket, Satish, if a bowler is getting a lot of licks, you know what the captain does? The captain is take him off and put him to go on field down by the boundary. Well, I'm not seeing that happening yet with the PNM. They have a lot of bowlers who are getting hit for 6 and 4 regularly by the population. So I don't know if there's going to be a change in the decks on the ship. But certainly the results of 2 Mondays ago would be cause for some sort of introspection on their part. I don't know how much change could be made in terms of, you know, what Dr. Rowley has available to him. I don't know if he'll be contemplating bringing new people into the Senate and bringing new faces into the cabinet. But, you know, the way our politics goes, they are now into their 8th year. September 7th will make it 8 years they're in government. And a lot of the faces, they have become pretty stale. And perhaps the Prime Minister may want to think about bringing on some new players, right? Like a football team. But it is getting late in the day, and before we know it, we say that there's 2 years to go to the 2025 election. But we all know 2 years in Trinidad and Tobago's political cycles is a drop in the ocean. Before we know it, we're going to be in January 2024, and we're going to be thinking about the general election of 2025, which, as I said, is a watershed election. It's an election which could make or break Trinidad and Tobago, depending on what we do after 2025. So I think I don't want to speak for the PNM, but I am speaking, you know, giving my thoughts. I thought this strategy to, I mean, you have people getting shoot and kill in Trinidad 6 and 7 every 2 days. And when you hear the ruling party speak, local government reform, you have industries being decimated, people losing jobs, and on the platform, local government reform, which of course is important, but that is not the burning issue of the day. The burning issue of the day is the criminality in the country and the fact that young people cannot get jobs commensurate with their qualifications. And there are people listening to me. I was in a restaurant in Coover a few days ago, and I was waiting for my food. And two gentlemen who were obviously retirees, you know, retirees tend to be in restaurants and bars in the middle of the day, came up to me and spoke to me about their children and what should their children do, because their children are about to university with engineering degrees. And I could tell you, in the last 8 years, the energy sector has lost 54% of its employment. So it's very difficult, if you have a chemical engineering degree, to find a job as a chemical engineer in Trinidad. If you have a mechanical engineering degree, it's hard to find a job. We have law graduates who can't get jobs. So the young professional class who we've told to go to school and get a job and so on, they are now, you know, without jobs.
Yeah,
and many of them are working in jobs which are not equated to their qualification. Mm-hmm. So what do people do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a discussion we have all the time, educating our population for jobs that at this point just simply don't exist. And that's the situation in Trinidad, but right across in Guyana, I read a story where the Guyanese economy outperformed Trinidad and Tobago, and that's expected with all that's taking place in Guyana, but it's a wake-up call for Trinidad and Tobago. But just before we move on, let's go back to this point that you raised about the campaigning and the messaging and whether or not the messaging resonated. And you suggested that while there were people who were saying this was a local government election and not a national one, the approach by the UNC was a national approach.
Of course. I mean, anywhere in the world where there's a national election, people deal with national issues. It is expected when you have midterm elections, as I said before, when you have midterm elections in the United States for governors, senators, and congressmen, they don't deal with issues of with local issues. The Republicans and Democrats deal with national issues. So I think it was a deliberate strategy by the PNM to avoid having to speak to crime and speak to the economy, because they have low marks in both areas.
But, okay, the reason why I brought it back up is this. On one hand, you had a party in power, that did not want to focus on these national issues and wanted to keep it hardcore local government. And on the other side, you had the other party saying, well, this is about national issues. This is about governance. And if you can't get governance in one area right, how you expect me to believe you'll get it right in another area? But the point is this. We saw one of the lowest voter turnouts ever, which me and the UNC, cumulatively, with the votes that were said to be NTA votes, got less votes than they got in 2019. And those are statistics, which suggests that the national discussion on issues as burning as crime didn't excite the population enough for them to want to come out and vote. That level of voter despondency, non-engagement, was concerning, because you did have the national issues being discussed.
You're spot on. There is a lot of voter apathy in the country. There are people who feel that the major political parties in the country cannot solve the problems of the country. And that is reflected in that voter apathy that we saw. Whether that will translate itself into 2025, we don't know. I think the voter turnout in 2020's general election was around 59%, which is a sort of low for a general election. General elections tend to be about 62%, 63%, 64% or thereabouts. I think there's a lot of voter apathy. One, Too, I also think that August is a time that we've been holding elections. So the last two elections have been held in August, local government 2023 mm-hmm. and general election 2020. And we know what happens in August.
Yeah,
a lot of people are out of the country. So you may have to factor that in too. But I would conclude that there's a lot of voter apathy. I think a lot of young people are definitely, I didn't see any young people voting on the 14th of August. I think a lot of young people are disconnected from the politics because they feel that the politics cannot solve their personal problems and the national problems. And therefore, one of the things that the two parties have to do is message to reach out to the young people. And the second thing, which I mean, this is a message for the UNC in particular. The difference between a general election and a local government election is that, as I pointed out last week, in a general election, you get more middle-class people coming out to vote. You get people, you know, you get the middle-class teachers and doctors and nurses and so on coming out to vote. How do you message such that you attract those people and excite those people?
Mm.
I think both parties have to think about that, but because those people have the bread and butter issues. If you are one of the issues affecting Canada right now, and you probably saw this plethora of videos moving around social media from Canada, is that people in Canada are becoming poorer and poorer because wages have stalled and inflation is spiraling in Canada. And doesn't that sound very familiar?
Mm.
That is what has been happening in this country. I mean, 100 Trinidad and Tobago dollars today would buy a lot less in a grocery than it would have bought 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Yet there are people in 2023 working on salaries from 2015 and 2016. And we saw the pilot issue last week, right? And that's a legitimate concern of pilots. Right? We have to look at both sides of the story. There are two sides of the story, right? But the pilot issue is multiplied throughout the country, right? I don't think the PSA has settled their wage negotiation with the CPO yet. And the PSA would represent, I think, about 80,000 workers in the public service. So you have public servants who are falling into poverty in Trinidad and Tobago, or on the edge of poverty, struggling to make ends meet.
Mm.
I know of one family where a child was taken out of university, right? Because the family couldn't afford the university education. So we have reached that point. So the other issue is how do we fix the economy come 2025?
Mm.
Because it's not going to be fixed in 2024. And 2020, and it's not going to be fixed by this current Minister of Finance.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fixed by him.
Well,
right? Because his economic strategy is clearly, I mean, they talk about avoiding the IMF, and that has been such a great achievement of the PNM. But we were in the IMF for the last 8 years, the Imbert Monetary Fund, right? And he has had his own policy of squeezing the money, holding back the money, and so on. And the economy has contracted by almost 20% under his watch. So that trajectory is not going to change under him. The other issue I pointed out last week is that there's a decline in our foreign reserves. And I think this issue became topical because of the Dr. Rowley comment about Guyana and the rebuttal from Vice President Jadbeil. I mean, I could tell you, our foreign reserves are $6.4 billion right now. And while that may be healthy relative to other CARICOM countries, that could vanish very quickly. And the trend in our foreign reserves is one of decline, constant decline. So I expect by this time next year when we talk, Satish, if we talk again in August 2024, our foreign reserves would probably be about $5.5 billion. And then if we talk again on the eve of the election in 2025, it might be $4.5 billion. Because what props up the foreign exchange is weakened. That's oil and gas production, right? So we are in this precarious position. One, yes, external forces, prices and so on, but two, very, very much the economic policies of the government were not expansionary, were not encouraging of investment. We increased taxes on the private sector. Our corporation tax is 30%. So that doesn't facilitate investment. It doesn't excite people to invest, right? And then, I mean, to do business in Trinidad is like going through a torture chamber. The amount of regulatory approvals that you have to get to do anything in Trinidad. Our ease of doing business is horrific now in Trinidad. The Jamaican government, for example, has been dealing with that. And today, Jamaica is an economy doing pretty well. They're not doing that well on crime, but the economy is picking up, and they've been consistently growing that economy in Jamaica. We all know the story in Guyana. I mean, if you're on LinkedIn, you're seeing the Trinidadian companies talking about what they're doing in Guyana.
Mm.
Right? I think it is Agostini has opened a huge facility in Guyana. That's a Trinidadian company. So the investment, the private sector, the Trinidad and Tobago private sector is not excited about investing here.
Yeah. Mr. Ramnarayan, we have just to take a couple of messages before we head up to news, but after the news, there's a question that we need to confront. And all that you're speaking about hinges on the 2025 election, or who gets to steer the ship from 2025 to 2030. And you have described this period as one of the most significant in the country's development. But are things being put in place to change the administration if the administration needs to change? Because from what you're suggesting, from all that has transpired, the Minister of Finance continues to take the country down a road that you do not think is the right direction for us. But to change that, because we've seen the Prime Minister in staunch defense of several of his ministers, the Minister of Finance is definitely one of those. So in order to change the trajectory, the administration would need to change. But are we putting things in place, the people who need to effect that change? And that's an important part of the discussion. We'll get to that after the 8 o'clock news. Our special guest for part two of our discussions, ladies and gentlemen, former Energy Minister Kevin Ramnarayan. We'll keep him on the phone for just a bit until after 8.
This is the Morning Rumble with Satish Mahabir.
4 minutes after 8. We continue with our discussions. Our special guest this morning, former Energy Minister Kevin Ramnarayan. We'll be taking some of your calls, but if you want to call us this morning, you're going to have to call us on 627-3223. That's the number for now, just that line, 627-3223. Mr. Ramnarayan, let's take one or two calls before we get back into our discussion. Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Ramnarayan. And good morning, Satish.
Morning, Eric.
Mr. Ramnarayan, I already made a clip a while ago about the question about how much is corporation tax. But you see, it feeds into my pet child, which is called the Revenue Authority. Because if you are not collecting all the taxes you're supposed to collect, how can you even think in such an atmosphere of lowering the taxes? And the fact that the opposition has this stranglehold on the country, where for 14 long years, the IMF, the World Bank, everybody has been saying we need to change our system of collecting taxes, and the best route is the Revenue Authority, and they refuse to do it. Secondly, I want to put on the table to you, Mr. Ramnarayan, this. In relation to the question of the Minister of Finance and what is it he is doing, we have to be honest. The Minister of Finance can only cut his suit with the cloth that he has. So if the country requires a suit made with four meters of cloth, and you only have 2.5 meters, that is what he has to cut it to.
Uh-huh.
So that when every sector keeps going to the Minister of Finance for money, he has to do his gymnastics in order to get it to them.
Mm.
So you can't blame the minister in an environment like this. Lastly, one other thing, Satish, I want to say this to you.
Say it.
Energy sector. Woodside recently made a find off the Gulf. They said at 2,000 meters. That sounds like good news to me. I'd like to hear a comment on that also.
Just before you go.
Yes, you're saying?
Yeah. Here's a question. This Saturday before the election, Colin Member held a press conference and announced to the world that they're going to give out a set of tax refund check and that kind of thing. Anybody get them checks on them?
I suppose they would. The minister is somebody who's an honest man. If you say he's going to do something, he doesn't.
Time will test his honesty, won't it? Thank you so much for your call. Mr. Ram Narayan, care to respond to some of these questions raised by Herrick? Hello? I'm not too sure. Mr. Ram Narayan, are you still? I'm not too sure we still have Mr. Ram Narayan on the phone. Let me see if I can get him back. It seems as though we've dropped the call. Stay with us. I think we do have Mr. Ramnarayan back with us. Good morning once again.
Yeah, good morning.
Yeah, Eric raised a set of questions about Revenue Authority and the Minister of Finance, hands tied, and he could only do so much with what he has and all of that kind of thing, and that the country is not experiencing the revenues. He spoke about Woodside and the announcement that they made. Do you see this Woodside announcement as a game changer?
Well, let's go back to the Minister of Finance. The Minister of Finance has pursued a pathway of austerity in the main. And I think a lot of that philosophy has manifested itself in things that we see around us, like the state of the roads in the country, and so, which could also be a result of other factors. But the country's economy, the philosophy that the minister adopted in 2015 when he took the reins of power, was one of increasing taxation on the private sector, increasing taxation and royalties on the energy sector. And the consequence of those decisions are before us today. If you look at gas production, it's significantly down to the point where it's threatening our economic existence. Oil production is on the way to the graveyard. Our local private sector is more interested in investments in Guyana and Jamaica and Barbados and the United States and so on. So we cannot continue beyond 2025 with the economic doctrine of Mr. Imbert. So I don't know if he is personally going to step out of politics or if he's going to offer himself up again. I see he was removed as chairman of the PNM. So I don't know if that's a sign that he's preparing to egress into retirement. But that philosophy is not something which is going to be transformative. It's not going to catalyze the transformation that we need in Trinidad and Tobago post 2025. Mm-hmm. Coming to Woodside, Woodside is pursuing something called the Calypso Project. Those blocks where Woodside found the Calypso field were awarded to Woodside's predecessor in 2012 by yours truly. It has taken too long. We should have had Woodside in production by now. Why are we don't even have a time frame as to when that gas is going to start to be produced, because they haven't approved the project. I awarded those blocks in 2012. We are talking now 11 years later. We should have been in gas production from the deep water by now. But it's taking too long, and we take too long to do things in Trinidad and Tobago, right? Touchstone is now coming into production with some gas. we awarded those blocks to Touchstone back in 2014. So we take too long to get a lot of these natural gas projects off the ground. And in the interim, you have the consequences of plant closure in Point Lisas and at Atlantic LNG. Again, our slowness is undermining our economic existence. And that's why the chemical engineers can't get jobs and the mechanical engineers can't get jobs and they want to go to live in Calgary and Houston and so on.
Let's take another call. Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning, Satish. Former Minister Ramnarayan, good morning to you. I am Mr. Kuep. BRICS is about to be laid at our doorstep, whether we are ready for it or whether we are ready for it. In your opinion, how can BRICS help us or hurt us going forward? I listen to your opinion off here. Thank you.
Well, that's a very important point because there are two major forces transforming the world. One is the energy transition, which is taking place where people are moving away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy and electric cars and so on. And the other one is the shift in global GDP, almost a tectonic shift in global GDP that is seeing the rise of the Asian countries. So therefore, we have to look at our relationship with China and we have to look at our relationship with India, two of the rising powers of the world. We have to look at our relationship to other Asian countries. Members of BRICS also include Brazil. What is our trading relationship with Brazil? And South Africa is also a large economy in the African continent. So the caller raises the point that, you know, we have traditionally looked to the United States to be our major trading partner, source of technology, and so on. But perhaps our foreign policy now, not perhaps, our foreign policy ought to be looking at China and India and deepening our trade ties with those countries. Because by the end of this decade, India is going to be the third largest economy in the world. China may be either the second or the largest economy in the world. So you can't function in the world of today and ignore those two countries. And those two countries are very, of course, central to the whole BRICS formula that is emerging. So it's a question of how our economic policy is intersecting with our foreign policy. So again, it calls for very enlightened leadership at the level of foreign policy.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I'd spoken to Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Brian Manning, some time ago about this whole same BRICS development thing, and he wasn't too bothered, to put it lightly. He didn't think that we would see any sort of real development in that regard anytime soon, even though he said it's something you need to keep your eye on. He wasn't necessarily as convinced that it should worry us at this point in time, which I thought was a pretty interesting perspective to come out of the Ministry of Finance. Let's take another call. Hello, good morning.
Good morning again, Satish, and good morning, Mr. Ramnarayan. Calling from Princess Tong. Mr. Ramnarayan, I agree with you that 2025 is going to be life or death for Trinidad and Tobago. But my question is, are our leaders, our politicians, our political parties, the media, all the stakeholders, are they providing the population with the right kind of leadership? Are they giving us the information as it is? Or are they not only engaging in peripheral rhetoric or perpetual euphemism? I am saying we establish a new national agenda that is realistic and come to the population with concrete proposals and ideas how we are going to save this country and stop the political rhetoric and nonsense and bacchanal we hear at a very important time when it's election for 2025. Your thoughts, please. Thank you.
Well, the first thing I would say to that is that the first and foremost role of leadership is to define reality. And what is reality? Reality is the truth. And have we been told the truth about the economy of Trinidad and Tobago by persons in government? Because every time I hear certain people in the government speak about the economy, you would swear this is Singapore or this is Dubai, right? But when they go to the industrial court, for when those wage negotiations reach the industrial court, you're probably hearing a different story when they're trying to defend their 4%, right? So there is a disconnect. And one of the challenges that we have faced historically in this country is this whole issue of truth, eh? Right? Where politicians don't necessarily tell the population what the reality is, but rather they tell them what is politically expedient. So you would hear that the economy is booming. You would hear that, you know, good times are ahead and, you know, we're doing so well and so on. But the reality is completely different. When you go to the malls, clearly the people in the country are not feeling that message that's coming from the government. So the first thing is to define reality. Where are we? If you have to navigate a ship from point A to point B, you have to know where point A is.
Yeah, you see, here's and this is a point I like to discuss because we need to. The stewardship of the country 2025 to 2030 is important. And all of the ills that you speak about, in order to correct them, you need to be in office. I mean, you could talk about them from here to high heavens. Call a member is not necessarily the kind of man who suggests with his past actions that he's take people on or take people's advice. Because the majority of economists, when they speak, he vilify them and dismiss their comments as being anti-government. And whatever else you could think about, Mr. Imber is not necessarily the one to take the advice, even from his own Economic Advisory Committee. So in order to effect the changes you speak of, you find yourself in government.
And well, I'll tell you something. Let's get straight into the politics and not
beat around the bush.
For the UNC to win the election, the UNC clearly has to hold on to the 19 seats it has. And it has to win at least two of three seats. And those seats are Tunapuna, San Fernando West, and La Hokata Talparo. And that will give the UNC 21 seats, at least 21 seats, maybe 22 seats in Trinidad. We have very little control over what the politics in Tobago, because we don't know how that's going to play out. So the UNC has to go into the election with a plan to win a majority in Trinidad. To win a majority in Trinidad, the UNC has to excite people in San Fernando West, Tunapuna, and La Hokata Talparo to come out and vote for them. St. Joseph, UNC, I forget St. Joseph in there too, sorry. So who are the people there? And those, I'm saying that the UNC has to have a message to excite the middle class voters in those seats, because the local government election is not necessarily a clear indicator of how the general election is likely to pan out. Because, as I pointed out, that 30% voter that will come out, because you got 30% turnout in last week, 2 weeks ago, and I'm saying that we'll get 60% in turnout in 2025. So that 30% difference is a lot of middle-class people who are very discerning, who want to understand what is your plan, who buy into credibility, who want to hear credible plans from credible people and so on. So the UNC, not just the PNM, the UNC has a lot of homework to do. And it's not all smooth sailing to 2025 and a foregone conclusion and so on. Because the PNM is a very resilient political party.
They got
almost wiped out in 1986 and they came back five years later they were back. So they are capable of reinvention. I don't know how much they could achieve in the next 2 years, but the UNC also has to examine St. Joseph, Tunapuna, San Fernando West, La Hoxha Talparo, hold on to Maruga Tableland, which is why that Lengua Indian Walk by-election is a critical election, and find a formula of persons to excite that middle class and to give people hope that there is a light at the end of the tunnel for Trinidad and Tobago, and hopefully the light at the end of the tunnel is not a train.
Are you considering running for office in 2024?
Well, I'd like to get back involved. The timing of that decision will have to happen before 2025.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I'm 51 years old right now, and I think I'm, you know, that is still a relatively young age. I could still climb some mountains in the northern range of Trinidad and Tobago, which I do from time to time. So mm-hmm. I feel I have the physical energy. I feel I have the experience. I have the mental faculties and so on to give it one more shot if the opportunity arises.
I had this discussion last week, because last week, of course, after the election, you had a range of emotions and thought processes taking place and people expressing them. And I had said to somebody, we were having the discussion, that Esmond Ford continues to campaign nonstop in Tunapuna. Without the trucks, without all that fanfare, his campaigning is more direct. He is in everything that you can think about.
I happen to know Esmond. On a personal level, he's a great guy. We went to the same high school. He's a bit older than me, but he's a Hillview boy. He's a man embedded in Tunapuna. He's a man who is all over Tunapuna. So he's a difficult, we have to face reality, as I said, define reality. He's a difficult candidate to go up against. And he has, you know, pretty much beaten the UNC soundly in 2015. I think he won by 4,000 votes in 2015. And in 2020, he won by almost 2,000 votes, I think. So he's a difficult nut to crack in Tunapuna, because a lot of it has to do with his personal brand,
mm-hmm.
right? So the UNC has to think very carefully about the demographics of Tunapuna, and, you know, the candidate election is going to be critical there, but not only candidate election, but, I mean, Mr. Dukuran won that seat in 2010, but that was, of course, a wave. Mr. Assam won that seat in, I think, 2001. Right? Or 2000, around there. 2001, I think.
Mm.
Mr. Assam won Tunapuna. But I know we have a lot of political historians listening. Mr. Assam would have won Tunapuna in the year 2000. He was moved from St. Joseph, which he had won in 1995. He was moved from St. Joseph to Tunapuna. And Carlos John was the candidate for St. Joseph in 2000. So Tunapuna is winnable. It was taken from the PNM in 2010, albeit part of a wave. The UNC won it in 2000. In 1995, it was narrowly lost by Hector McLean. So it's always been a seat that is very tight. But I think with the right candidate and a scientific campaign and so on, anything is possible there.
Mm.
But I would agree with you that Esmond is a very worthy opponent.
Let's see if you have another call. 627-3223, 625-2257. No, actually, 627-3223 is our number while we have the interview ongoing. Let's see if you have another call. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from Bukaro. And good morning to the learning, Mr. Ramnamindia.
Where are you calling from?
From Bukaro.
Okay.
Yeah. Firstly, I must say, I want to agree with him, and I want to agree with you with Esmond Ford, because I remember the last time when he was going up there, I said to them, he's a people's person, and he would have won the seat very easily. And it happened, and it may happen again for the next election. I put a few suggestions on the radio to the UNC. If they want to win the next election, Mr. Ramnan, I would like you to make a little comment on it. I am saying, out of the 41 seats, you've got to put candidates now. You've got to put them to work the area and let the people decide who they want between the candidates to go up for the seat. You see how Mr. Osmond Ford worked that seat? Just so you have to have the people working for free. for these 3 years that is coming up here, and not when election time comes, you put your friend, your family, and your financiers worker to put them there because you have a surety seat and they would win it. No, the 9 marginal seats in Trinidad determine the election. I heard you call 4 there, but I just say 9. As I just say, it's 16, 16 plus 9 marginal seats. And if they, I believe that if they put candidates now to work the area and let the people agree or disagree with them, so you would be in a better position to put a candidate there so the people would know who they are going to vote for. But those marginal seats that you are speaking about, those are the seats that will determine the election. And I think the seats in Tobago would definitely go to the man who have it there right now. I don't think the PNM would win that 2 seats. So that would mean PNM would be 2 seats less out of their 16. There would be 14 because those two would go for Tobago. And probably that may make the decision in the election to who to come prime minister, whether the Tobago man or the Trinidad person. Mr. Wanayan, I'd be like if you can make a comment.
I completely agree with you.
Go ahead.
The UNC has to embed those candidates in those marginal seats, not 3 weeks before the election, but, you know, well before the election, maybe a year before the election. I remember when I was in the parliament between 2010 and 2015, around 2014 or thereabouts, Satish, it was pretty obvious who the candidate for San Fernando West was going to be, and that was Farris. Because Farris wasn't yet announced formally as a candidate, but he was obviously directed to go and work the seat. So by the time the election came around in 2015, he was already, you know, miles ahead, right? And of course, when a candidate knows that they're getting a seat with 3 weeks to go before election, they don't have much time. So that is a quote caller makes an excellent point. Candidates for those marginal seats have to be embedded long before.
I remember in 2015, or I think it was 2015, or yeah, it had to have been 2015. I was telling people about Esmond Ford. I came on the radio and I said to them that Esmond Ford is going to be, he's going to prove to be a real challenge, because my daughter at the point in time, just a couple of years before, was in a preschool in El Dorado, not too far from Hillview College, and Esmond used to be in everything. The school having a little get together for whatever, there's half things all the time. Esmond would come, even if he had come for 5 minutes. I don't know how he used to do it, but he was always, it seemed that everywhere you turn, Esmond is there. He was always in every single thing. And it's not so much about what you say to people, you know, it's your actions speak a lot louder. And many people, when he came, I saw people gravitating towards him. They wanted to speak to Esmond. And even though he probably couldn't remember half of what they said to him, he gave everybody the impression that he was genuinely concerned about what they was talking about. If he was pretending, he was doing a real good job. And we saw the results. Quietly, yes, campaigning. And he used to go house to house.
I mean, that obviously remains a difficult seat for the UNC to pull away from the PNM. St. Joseph, not so difficult.
Oh, okay. Let's...
I think the margin by which St. Joseph was lost was under 1,000 votes. So you have to look at St. Joseph as a
winnable seat
for the 2025 election. I don't know if Terence's Minister Dial Singh, is going to go for another term, but he's won the seat now 3 consecutive times. Remember, he won it as a
by-election.
In a by-election in 2013. Then he retained it in 2015 and 2020. So I don't know if he's up for a fourth knock. But it's not a difficult seat for the UNC to win.
With
a proper candidate, with the correct candidate and the correct campaign team and so on.
Let's take another call. Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The ex-energy minister there, he mentioned that UNC probably need to make themselves attractive to voters. Or more correctly, they need to make themselves attractive to voters beyond their base. And so far, let's say, if we examine UNC position on energy matters, you know, they do everything in their power to stymie any kind of energy approach, like for instance the Dragon deal. They will put forward all means or all probably true facts of how it can be done instead of zeroing on positive things. In the Venezuela situation, they criticize Rowley for dealing with Maduro, and now we see the USA going and hugging up Maduro to some extent. We get a 2-year deal, which is normal for executing projects. They sabotage that. UNC must realize that the public looking on, the public beyond their base is looking on, and their performance in that regard is so pathetic and unpatriotic. I don't know who we want to impose UNC, a government like that. And Mr. Ramanian, I think probably you have no choice other than to go back to the UNC or whatever, but I think that will be doing yourself and the country a disservice if you wish to go back to UNC under Ms. Kamala Prasad Bisesa, who all my fears about her has been confirmed by the comments of Guy, the comments of Jack Warner, the comments of Obika, Gypsy, all of them who confirm her lack of talent. She's one of the worst prime ministers Trinidad ever have. I don't know how they want to reimpose UNC back on the public, but I don't think you have much of a choice now.
Okay, thank you so much for your call.
I just want to make one point about Venezuela and Dragon. And that is, regardless of who is the government of Trinidad and Tobago, Trinidad and Tobago has diplomatic relations with Venezuela. So whoever is the government of Trinidad and Tobago come 2025 will have to continue those talks with Venezuela on those natural gas projects. So that doesn't go away, right? Because we've had a long and cordial relationship with Venezuela. When I was minister, I had a great relationship with Venezuela. There were times when the Venezuelan government was facilitative of the work that we were doing offshore and so on with our exploration, because from time to time, you know, we have to have cooperation with them on exploration in terms of movements of ships and vessels and so on. So whoever is the government of Trinidad and Tobago, call her. We have an embassy in Caracas with an ambassador, and we have diplomatic relations with Venezuela, and that will not change. So we continue to talk to them.
Take another call. Hello, good morning.
Morning, Satish, and Mr. Ramnarayan. Mr. Ramnarayan, since about 50 years, we speak about lessening our dependency on the energy sector. 50 years. Today, we are more dependent on that sector than anywhere else. Our every $100 in foreign exchange you earn, $85 come from the energy sector. $85. And we need foreign exchange. Right? So this country has gone nowhere. We have gone backward. After 8 years of PNM rule, we are nowhere. We have gone backward. And that deal in Venezuela, the new Minister of Energy, he wanted to ask Maduro how he could give us oil without any cash. The new minister, because the last minister keeps us the money and gone. The point is, how would it move this country? And because Mr. Rowley said the word diversification is a nasty word. He don't want to hear in the cabinet. The point is, how are you going to move this economy and reduce the dependency from oil? I'd like to hear your view on that. Thank you.
Well, you know, as I pointed out, there are some major global changes taking place. We are a small country of 1.4 million people in the Caribbean. We have to understand those changes and how we remodel our economy to meet those changes. One of the major changes taking place in our region is what's happening in Guyana and what will soon happen in Suriname. What that will mean for this region is that there's going to be an increase in the amount of maritime traffic in this region, because more vessels will be going to Guyana, more vessels will be going to Suriname. So Trinidad and Tobago could position itself, or should position itself, to be the maritime services hub of the region. Given our natural advantages with deep water harbors and our port infrastructure and the skills that we have in Trinidad and Tobago in the maritime sector, that should be where we're looking to diversify the economy into. And there's a natural marriage between that sector and the offshore oil and gas sector. So you are combining, you are finding, you are marrying your strength with an emerging opportunity. And that is where I see, but that strategy requires huge political will.
Mm.
And it requires a lot of strategic thinking and vision and so on. And that is a whole other discussion. But the opportunity is there to create thousands of jobs in that sector.
Let's take what might be our final call for the interview before we wrap up. Hello, good morning.
Mr. Ramnarayan, good morning again, Satish and Mr. Ramnarayan. When I spoke earlier this morning, Satish, I kind of confused the question. Actually, when we decided I was speaking of Trinity. Trinity did something down in Palo Seco region, offshore, where they found a deep water at roughly around 2,000 meters.
No, that was on land. Palo Seco is on land, not in deep water.
Right, and the Jacobin One field. Right? Now, it really and truly tells me that we live in a sector, a region that is really and truly hydrocarbon rich. We just have to find it. And the fact that they're finding all this oil in Guyana and Suriname, and we know Venezuela has the largest reserves on the planet, speak volumes of Trinidad and Tobago in the future. But I'd like to hear your comment on what happened, what is going to happen with that Trinity discovery in the Palo Seco region. Thank you.
Well, all we have from Trinity so far is a press release. I would wait to see what the production would be. So we haven't seen, you know, I always use this phrase, the proof is in the production. So let's wait to see. But the point the caller is making is that that part of the country that he refers to, Palo Seco, Santa Flora, and so on, there still is a tremendous amount of oil in the ground down there. But it has to be, you have to drill. You have to drill to get it. And the business model, in my opinion, of Heritage Petroleum has to change, and they have to move to farming out a lot of their acreage to small private companies, which we call the lease operators, that are faster and, you know, could go after these low-hanging fruit in that part of the country. But that business model is something I think Heritage Petroleum has to address.
As we wrap up our interview this morning, our second discussion thus far on looking forward to 2025, and we can see that there are a number of things that need to be considered, more prominently among them, the politics. I don't want to use the term getting the politics right, but putting things in place if they need to be put in place, if people feel that the stewardship would not be the best, and there needs to be a change. As you can hear, there are some people who don't agree with that position. Some people believe that things are going well, and once they continue the way they're going, everything will work out okay. I'll ask you the same question that I asked as we wrapped up our interview last time around. We've had a number of bits and pieces falling into place since then. We've had some announcements in the energy sector. The Energy Chamber has put out a really, really intricate analysis of what's going on when it comes to the energy sector. The question I want to ask you is this. All these issues that we discuss, these implications and the possible outcomes, negative, positive, and everything else, do you believe the population, the voting population, is mature enough to consider those things when an election comes around?
And the answer, I think the answer is a definite yes. The population of Trinidad and Tobago is very informed, very discerning, and, you know, probably one of the more advanced societies in the Caribbean. Of course, race plays a role. I mean, that is what has been researched over and over again by people like Southern Ryan and so on. Race always plays a role in our elections. But there are always people who will vote on issues. So you have the two entrenched political parties with their bases, and both of them are around 300,000. But in between, that's 300,000 voters, not necessarily 300,000 votes. But in between, you have another 300,000 people who are looking to the politicians for solutions, who are looking for jobs for their children, who are in university today, who want to make sure that they live in a society that is safe. So how does the UNC and the PNM speak to that center? And that historically has been the center, the political center, that was captured by the COP or was captured by the ONR back in the 1980s. And that center is looking for home, for a political home. They're looking to make a political investment, and but before they do that, before they make that leap, they have to see credible people, credible plans, you know, and some sort of coherence from a political force. And the battle for 2025, Satish, is really the battle for that center, right? Which was the old COP, the old COP base. Well, I don't want to say old COP because it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Ramon, we're going to end our interview here this morning. But it's been a pleasure speaking with you again. And you can tell from the interaction with our callers that, well, callers are very much concerned about what's going to happen in 2025 as well. So thank you once more for being with us here this morning.
Okay, thank you. And thanks to all the very active and robust callers.
Yes. I'm sure that we'll have another conversation in not too long from now. That, of course, ladies and gentlemen, how we end our interview here this morning with former Energy Minister Kevin Ramnarayan. A couple messages. We'll be right back. Stay with us.